We all have dreams at night. Each and every one of us have or has had dreams. Some dream in black and white. Some dream in color. How many of you dream in color? Whoa, look at those hands pop up. How many of you dream in 4D high def stereo? Oh, that's not good. You're going to die young. That's not good. Some people, as you know, they talk in their sleep. How many of you have spouses that talk in their sleep? See, those spouses know that's funny. But let me ask you, what is a dream? A dream is a wish your heart, I can't believe this, you guys, of all the people in the continental United, in the world, where's that from? Cinderella. No, a dream is a wish your heart makes. But the Bible uses dreams as a major form of communication. And you may know that there are almost 24 dreams in the Bible, 10 of them alone in the book of Genesis. There's at least 6 kings, 1 woman, and 2 Josephs, all who had dreams. Now, don't count them now, because I know what you're doing. In your head, you're starting to rattle off who they are. All right, forget it. Let's go ahead and count a few of them. All right? Name me some kings. Quick. Come on, you're killing me here. What? So we're going to talk about Daniel. Give me another one. Pharaoh. Abimelech. Right? So that's in Solomon. There's more. Tell me the Josephs. It's okay. This is audience participation. Huh? The stalker. Joseph wasn't a stalker. What? Coat of many colors, Joseph. Correct. What was the second Joseph? Husband of Mary. That's right. And who was the woman? There's at least one, maybe 2 or 3. What's one of the most prominent? To a degree. Pilate's wife. That was a nightmare. So dreams are important. And dreams in mind, let's turn to the book of Daniel. Now, I've spoken on Daniel before. In fact, I did a series on this about 25 years ago, and it took me 6 months to go through it. This is probably going to wind up close to, if not a little late, into the construction project on the 710. But I started one about a month and a half ago, and with the speaking schedules and the rotation we have, I've only been able to get to Daniel chapter 2 today. It's difficult, but I think it's important. I prefer series. When we lived back east, I did almost nothing but series of books, series of concepts. And Daniel was one of my favorite because it's got some great, great studies. In Daniel 1, if you'll remember, Daniel and his 3 buddies, name them, please. Oh, great. You remember their pagan Babylonian names. That's very good to know. Yeah. Huh? Close enough. Good. Very good. They were taken captive in approximately 602 BC, carted off from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. Approximately 15 years later, Jerusalem was sacked and almost destroyed. So in Daniel 1, you recall that it was the issue of what will they eat? They were not going to eat the delicacies from the king's table, whether that meant they were unclean foods or they were defiled in sacrifice, which is my thinking, because it was both food and drink, and they would not eat them. So Daniel asked the chief of the officers, please, veggies only, no gluten, and see how we are in a few days. And sure enough, it worked. And Nebuchadnezzar saw that they indeed were some of the brightest and wisest in all the kingdom. It's about living in Babylon, and that's why the book is so instructive. Living in Babylon, quote unquote, is a euphemism for God's people living under a foreign, semi-pagan world system to one degree or another. Many people, we are in full-fledged Babylon. We're in it. We are in Babylon. Some feel it's in steps. Slow steps. Some feel it is coming very slowly, very, very slowly, but nevertheless, like a frog in water, they turn up the heat. Before the frog knows it, the frog's been boiled, but it takes a long time. Daniel's book gives us the concept of what to expect, how to react, and how not to react. So today, in this protracted series, in Daniel chapter 2, where we're going to explore, how do we live while we were in Babylon? You want a title? I thought about this. I asked Becky. I call it, It's a Bad Dream. So turn to Daniel chapter 2 with me, if you would. Daniel chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. And that's in the plural. And his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I've had a dream. My spirit is anxious to know this dream. So he calls his troops. He calls his enchanters, his magicians, his sorcerers, and he calls a very special class of people known as the Chaldeans. These are the boys that consulted the stars, the dead, the living, goat entrails, and Google. They even believe they communicated with the gods of Babylon. They believe that they were in touch with them. What's interesting is the Chaldeans or the Babylonians were astronomers of the first rank. The Chaldeans here may be the groups that we think originated the concept of the constellations, some of which we still use today. That's how good of an astronomer they were. Keep in mind, there's astrology, which is next to looking at goat entrails, but you look at the stars instead, and there is astronomy, which is the science of the movement of the planets. And they were scientists to a great degree. They had consulted with the Babylonian kings forever. And their track record, if you think about it, these men that Nebuchadnezzar called had to have had some success, else why would he have them around, right? You don't keep around people that you can't use, that don't perform. And so they were there for a reason. So they had to be right once in a while. Verse 4, then the Chaldeans, they spoke up, and they spoke to the king in Aramaic. O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. Now, at this point, things change very quickly. The word Aramaic, or maybe in your translation it says Syriac, that was the Yiddish of its day, and it replaced Akkadian. It was a very common language. Aramaic, in some dialects, is spoken even today. He says, tell us the dream. They said, tell us the dream, and we will interpret it, O king. Now, everything has started off kind of nice, happy. It's going to turn ugly, very quickly, because the king is going to throw them a curveball. It's going to be tight and inside, and he indeed is aiming right for their head, as we shall see. It's going to hit him right in the head. Note one, note memo to self. When king is mad, don't get him madder. When he's angry, don't get him more angry. And so verse 5, the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, there are two parts, you shall be cut in pieces. Your houses shall be made an ash heap. However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, for the third time, the king says, tell me the dream, tell me the interpretation. They answered. And here begins an unbelievably fascinating exchange. It's very similar to what Mr. Brown read earlier in the first message about an exchange. And exchanges are important in the Bible. There's quite a few of them, but they're all very important because it shows people's motivations. And so they answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will tell the interpretation. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time because you see that my decision is firm. What do we call that today? Stalling. Very good. That's Aramaic for stalling. They're stalling. My decision is firm. Verse 9, if you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. You're just going to wait out the clock. You're just going to keep asking me over and over again, and you think I'm going to change my mind. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. You can count 3 or 4, in some cases 5 times, he has asked this question of them. This isn't good. Basically, the king is saying, you're so wise and knowledgeable. Tell me what I dreamed. Tell me the meaning. And it goes back and forth. In fact, he says in verses 5 and 6, he says very clearly, he says, if you don't answer, you're dead, and so is your family. It'll be an ash heap. If you're correct and you tell me, you will receive great riches. Now, I want you to take this from the perspective of the Chaldeans, the astrologers, and the soothsayers. They're in a lot of trouble. Just work with me. They're in a lot of trouble. Why are they in a lot of trouble? Because they know they don't know. Who else knows they don't know? The king. The king is on to them, and he has threatened them with death if they don't tell him both the dream and the interpretation. What's interesting in your Bibles, most of you, does everybody pretty much have the word cut in pieces in verse 5? Cut in pieces. Technically, I did some research on this. In the Expositor's Bible Commentary, Archer Gleason had this to say. Limb from limb is what it is in the original. There is no word cut in the original. There is no implement for cutting. Therefore, the limb from limb may refer to a Babylonian type of death involving four bent trees, tall, bent trees, that are secured at the top with rope. They're bent, taut. To each four trees is an arm and a leg. The trees are then released. Does that give you a visual? And they said that is probably closer to what happened, rather than just being cut in pieces. It was a torturous death. These men knew they were in trouble, and they were in big trouble, and it's going to get even uglier. And so he's basically threatening them. That verse 10, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, note to self, not another wise answer. They tell the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a stupid thing of his advisors. They basically have inferred, you're nuts. No one has ever asked this. This is Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, they are speaking to. So they know they're in trouble, and it don't look good. He says, no one has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests. There is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Now, this is such a poignant set of verses, because we know what happens in this chapter. If you're not familiar with it, you'll see both those sentences played out, because both those sentences are wrong, according to the book of Daniel. The statement is, there is no man on earth who can tell this, who understands this. Number two, there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Both of those in the book of Daniel are proven to be wrong. And that is so, so important. This also implies, so important, that the king is deranged, according to the Chaldeans. Can you imagine how desperate your situation is that you start calling the king names? He does that. They do that. In verse 10, the Chaldeans, not a man on earth, except the gods, no one on earth. Verse 12, this sets him off. For this reason, the king was, now notice the words here in all translations, the king was angry and very furious. I'm not sure what the difference is. I looked it up, and they're both meaning he was fit to be tied. However, they are the ones that are going to be tied. He was angry and very furious. He gave the decree or the command to destroy all the men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and he began to kill the wise men. He also says, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them as well. They were considered part of the retinue of the wise men. So because of this, he said, in the Aramaic, if you look very closely in the Aramaic, it's very clear, you're toast. In fact, he said probably, get the trees ready. And so this is in the active sense of he is beginning to kill them, and he's hunting down Daniel and his friends. They're going to be included. It shows you there's an awful lot of wise men that the king has at his disposal, and he's going to be systematically destroying them. Verse 14, then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent? Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. This is interesting. Recall from Daniel 1, chapter 20, that Nebuchadnezzar knew of and had questioned Daniel. He knew he was wise, and he was with the captives that came from Israel. And those captives from Israel were the young wise men from Jerusalem, from Judah. And so he was well aware of him, of his wisdom. And so Arioch explains to him what is going on, what's happening here. Daniel asked basically, Arioch, what is happening and why? Two questions. What's happening and why is it happening? What's with all these trees? I just added that. Arioch explains, Daniel goes to the king. He goes to the king, so Daniel went in, verse 16, and asked the king to give him some time, that he might tell the king the interpretation. This is another critical verse relative to Daniel. He's asked for time. Does he receive it? If he does receive it, what does it say about Daniel? He says, can I have some time? So he says, Daniel went to his house. They tell the king, and Daniel went to his house, so he obviously was given time. He made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. This is so, so very important as well. Daniel finds out from Arioch when he goes to the king of what has happened. It says in verse 14 that he took counsel and wisdom. Those words are variously interpreted many ways. But in essence, it says he used prudence and discretion when he spoke with Arioch. Arioch was on a mission to hunt down and destroy the wise men. So who does he see in front of him? Daniel, one of the wise men. What should have Arioch done? He should have killed him. That was his mission. Arioch should have killed him. He could have done it right then and there and saved some trees. But he didn't. He wants to have access to the king. He's given the access to the king. The king agrees when he's asked for more time. Why? Why is Daniel given all this access in this kind of a situation? Because it says he was there with counsel and wisdom. Verse 16 gives us a little window into this. Daniel goes to his house and he lets his friends know almost immediately. How does one live in Babylon? How does one cope? Well, I think among others, there are at least five decisions that are made. And we're going to see just a few of them in a second. But first, we're going to read the prayer in verse 20. Daniel answered and said to God, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him." Isn't this very similar to the special music that we heard? This is the God that we talked about in the special music. He says, "I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and now have made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand." Therefore, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation." Stunning. Stunning. So Daniel, with these issues that he had, the specific issues that are brought up here, Daniel sizes up the situation. It ain't good. He does this quickly. He sizes up the situation, finds out there's a decree, but he needs more information. So he asks, and he goes to the king. He asks for time. He used the prior relationships that he had with both Arioch and those that were over the captives of Jerusalem, and his relationship, the good impression he had made with King Nebuchadnezzar. He knew there was no way out. He knew death awaited him and his friends and all the captives that were considered wise men. Indeed, he knew his humility and his wisdom were there. And we shall see It was this inherent use of God's Spirit that God gave to Daniel. It is this faithful attitude that Daniel shows here in the prior chapter and all the succeeding chapters of this book. That it's not so much faith in yourself per se, which we should have some internal confidence, but it's the faith and confidence that people have and Daniel had in God. So watch as this continues. He merely says after this prayer, this beautiful prayer he's been given, after God has given him the vision of the interpretation and the dream itself, take me to the king. I have the answer. Why did Arioch trust him and believe him? Why did the king give him more time? It's obvious. He had these great relationships proven by his attitude. Verse 25, then Arioch, watch, this verse is so interesting. Then Arioch quickly, yeah, I'll bet, brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king an interpretation. Did he trust Daniel? He just put his life on the line by saying, this guy's got the answer. I found him. I found this guy, Daniel. No, we know that Daniel had already been before the king. So I found this man. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me? Here's the two questions. Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, leaves out the Chaldeans. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, what will be in the latter days. It's a very common expression in the Old Testament, the latter days, the end time, the days to come. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about the world, what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living. But for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. That's quite a buildup. Notice again this humility of Daniel. Remember also what the Chaldeans had prophesied, or had stated emphatically. Nobody knows this answer. Not even the gods, because they do not dwell with men. Now both those comments are now going to be proven false. There was a man, and there was a God who gives the answers, and that human that he gave the answers to is sitting in front of him. In another chapter, we'll come to whether God will dwell with man in the same book. Note again his humility. He is giving full and complete credit to God, that God is trying to communicate with King Nebuchadnezzar, that Daniel is merely an instrument of God's will. That's what he's there for. He said, it is not that I am wise, that I understand these things. He had to ask for it. He had to pray for it. And he did so with his friends. Note also that he does not describe other than he who dwells in heaven. He doesn't give him any other descriptor except that phrase. And this God, O King Nebuchadnezzar, is speaking to you in your dream. God is trying to communicate with this pagan king, which is of and by itself most interesting. The next and final sections are in two parts. The dream is detailed and then interpreted. Exactly as the king desired, Daniel had gone to God, received what the dream was about and what the dream meant. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar had only seen the dream. He had no clue what it meant. Daniel asked God, and God would deliver. Verse 31, part 1. You, O king, were watching in the night vision a dream. And behold, a great image. That great image was splendor, was excellent, and stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, and that's different than just gold, fine gold. Its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. Now, I want you at this point, picture this scene. Here is this Jewish captive in front of King Nebuchadnezzar. Arioch is probably there and the other attendants. And Nebuchadnezzar, if you were Nebuchadnezzar and you'd had this dream and it troubled you, this image, and you have this young captive in front of you describing what you've dreamed, what would your reaction be? How about jaw open, chin on floor, leaning forward? He's been able to do what none of the soothsayers, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, those, the guys that looked at entrails, those that looked at the sun, moon, and stars, none of them could determine what this was. So picture this scene. So he talks about the gold, the silver, the bronze, and the iron, and partly iron feet of clay. Verse 34, you watched while a stone was cut out without hands and struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, and silver and gold, in reverse order, were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floor. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Nebuchadnezzar is probably thunderstruck. Not only as he tells him about an image, he gives him details, specific details. It's an image in four stages with four prime metals. Metallurgically, you may find this interesting. Gold, silver, bronze, and iron, or iron and clay, each has a decreasing worth, even today. Decreasing worth and also decreasing density. Metallurgically, a density. Two are precious metals, two are base metals. Do you want the numbers on density? Does that make you do? Some of you do. Good. You can Google this. Gold is on grams per cc. Gold is 19.3. Silver around 10.5. Bronze, with various content of tin as well as copper, is 8.4. And iron's density is 7.8. Now, their hardness is different. Gold is very soft. In fact, he uses the phrase fine gold. That would be very, very pure gold. Extremely soft, and you can bend it with your hands. It's not good for much of anything, but it is very dense, very soft. So it's interesting. These are the metals that are used, and they're used in the order that they are. There's also, as a cross-reference, if you want to look up later, Isaiah chapter 60, verse 17, these same metals are referenced. So these metals were very common to the day. The feet, being clay and iron, are worth almost nothing. They don't mix well, dirt and iron. Finally, Daniel says, a stone is cut without hands. A rock is cut out without hands and strikes the image at the base, and it creates dust. Then the stone fills the earth, Daniel says, and becomes a mountain. So these four successive stages of the image, gold, silver, bronze, iron, and clay, they're interesting. The word, because you know what he's talking about, because you've read the book of Daniel in this chapter so many times, you know what he's talking about. Yet there's one word missing in the dream that is never mentioned by Daniel. The word kingdom. The word kingdom is not used here. It's only the dream, not the interpretation. And so this stone is cut out. It breaks apart the entire structure. The king was well aware of these metals. He knew their worth. He knew their worth just because of common practice, because of the art, decorations, and jewelry of Babylonian artwork at the time. He knew their worth. But he had no idea about the meaning. What does this mean? This image, and you've seen pictures of this image. They're all over our booklets, other prophetic booklets. It's on the web. Very important. So what's the interpretation? Can you imagine Nebuchadnezzar at this point? He is on the edge of his seat. He's wondering, what in the world does this mean? Because this kid knows. This person knows. And he's talking to a god of some kind. He's got this information from a god. And now we hear the interpretation, verse 36. This is the dream. Now we will tell you the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom. This is from God. He's given you power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over all them all. You are this head of gold. But, and it's a big but after you shall arise another kingdom, inferior to yours. He doesn't mention it, but it's the silver kingdom. Another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron. Inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere one to another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to you, the king, what will come to pass in the latter days or after this. The dream is certain. Its interpretation is sure. In other words, this is the truth. There is no debate. What is the king thinking? What is possibly going through this man's mind? It's good news and bad news in some ways. You are the head of gold, but it will not last. Each successive kingdom was inferior, as were the metals. We have, as others, our church has interpreted as others have, that it is the Babylonian, succeeded by the Medo-Persian, the Grecian Empire, and finally Rome. When we think of Rome, because that is closest to our history, we hear the most about it on the History Channel or in books. In fact, on Spotify, many of us are listening to the history of Rome on Spotify, and it's long history, colorful history, sad history. We think of Rome, and we think of iron. We think of Pax Romana, which conquered what was mainly in the known world. We think of it as the greatest. That's not what Daniel says. The book of Daniel says, of far and away, it's Babylon. Babylon was the greatest kingdom. It's gold, not iron. Greece, we think of Alexander the Great. It too is subservient to the greatness of Babylon. And that is hard for us sometimes to think. It just wasn't. These other nations, these other kingdoms were not the greatest. It was Babylon. That is what the image is saying. And we can read it. What about the stone cut without hands that struck the base? Kind of at the base, on a building, what do you call the corner of the base? You call it the cornerstone. What was the cornerstone of the image? The stone hit. The stone cut without hands. We interpret it as Jesus Christ. Mr. Brown brought this up. This kingdom that God ushers in through Jesus Christ will come about. He is the rock. He is the stone. He is called the chief cornerstone repeatedly. Hold your hand in Daniel chapter 2 with me, please, and let's turn very briefly to Luke chapter 20. There's a very interesting parable that Jesus gives in Luke chapter 20, and we're going to pick it up most of the way through. You're familiar with it. It's called the parable of the vineyard, the parable of the vineyard and the wicked vine dressers. And it talks about a certain man planted a vineyard, and he had vine dressers. And he had sent servants to the vine dressers. They might give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the vine dressers beat him and sent him away. Finally, the owner sends his son. And we know exactly who this son is. It's Jesus Christ. In verse 16, we pick it up. And Jesus, in his own words, says, he will come and destroy those vine dressers and give the vineyard to others. Now, he's speaking to the chief priests, scribes, along with the elders. And they heard it and they said, no way, you can't be serious. Because he knew that they knew that he was talking about them. Then he, Jesus, looked at them and said, what then is this that is written. It's a very famous phrase in the New Testament. This is that. That's what it's called. What is this that says that? The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Whoops. Whoever falls on that stone will be broken, but on whomever it falls, it will grind him to powder. And the chief priests and the scribes were happy to hear this. No, they weren't. That very hour, they sought to lay hands on him. Jesus himself says he is that stone. Paul says in Corinthians chapter 10 that that stone, that rock that followed the Israelites in the wilderness, that stone, that rock was Christ. Christ is the stone kingdom, and it becomes a mountain. It becomes a great mountain. Whereas Babylon and Rome and Greece and the Medo-Persian Empire lasted only for a short time, Christ and God's kingdom lasts forever. But this concept of the stone in this image of Daniel in the interpretation becoming a great mountain is important. In the International Bible Encyclopedia, of the gods of Babylon, there was one that had the name of Shadu-Rabu, was later applied to Marduk. Guess what it means? Great mountain. So the symbolism here to Nebuchadnezzar and his wise men and those that were in attendance while this interpretation is being given was very poignant. This stone that strikes the image on its feet becomes a great mountain, replaces the gods of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar could not have missed this analogy. It is a linear history that we know, a prophecy, that Christ's return will strike at the nations, toppling whatever system exists at the time. But what's interesting, we go back to Daniel chapter 2, if you flip back there with me. Oh, the marker fell out of my Bible. What page is it? Does anybody know? Thank you. There we go. What's interesting about this is that it's a linear history. Though the kingdoms are successive in the image, they all symbolically topple at once. They all topple at once. The stone doesn't hit the gold head first, and then the silver, then the bronze, then the iron. It strikes at the feet and topples the whole thing. Symbolically, it topples all at once. We're told three times, as you're probably well aware, in the book of Revelation, in chapters 14, 17, and 18. What does it tell us in the book of Revelation? Babylon has fallen. He doesn't talk about Rome. John doesn't talk about Greece. He doesn't talk about the Medo-Persian Empire. He talks about Babylon. Also note this, as Daniel is giving the interpretation to the king, Daniel would never see this happen. He never would see these nations rise and form. He only saw the head of gold. Remember that this is Babylon. John wrote the book of Revelation during the time of Rome's dominance, Rome's occupation of the Judean Empire. So neither one of these men saw the final outcome. What's important is that this system of Babylon encompasses all world systems. That's why it is used in Revelation by John written during this Roman occupation, yet it would not be final. Here's a question for you. How should this relate to us? Near or close to the kingdom of God, our actions should be consistent. Whether it is 10 years, 50 years, or 100 years away, our actions should be consistent. Daniel says, God has made this vision, this dream, known to the king. There is no doubt as to its meaning. It's the truth. Daniel never questioned God's revealing it to him. He never doubted. He simply thanked God, got up, and went to the king. Not once did Daniel say to God, but when will this happen? When will this be? When will be the time of the stone empire striking the rest? He simply thanked God, got up, and went to the king. Daniel has his life spared and his friends. Let's read verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face. I'll bet he did. Picture this again. Is this a scene out of a crazy movie? King Nebuchadnezzar, the most powerful man on the planet, in Daniel's world in any event. He falls on his face. He's prostrate. That means his arms are out. His head is down. He is bowing before Daniel. He commands that they should present an offering, an incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of the kings, and a revealer of secrets. Since you could reveal this secret," and he did. He gave exactly what was asked of him. He was asked, "What did I dream? Tell me what I dreamed. Now tell me what it means." Daniel was the only one that could do that. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts. He made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. What is this reminiscent of? Joseph. It's analogous to Joseph. He's the chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Now that must have made the wise men of Babylon, the Chaldeans, the astrologers, the soothsayers, the entrail lookers, that must have made, they were probably, no, they were not happy, as we will see in the next chapter. We won't read that today, but we'll see what happens very quickly. So indeed, when we picture this scene, this great human ruler who 5 minutes earlier was in the process of killing every wizard, whatever you want to call him, every wizard in sight, is bowed before this Israelite captive. His bad dream was revealed. His bad dream was interpreted. Recall, there are no chapter breaks in Daniel. They don't exist. The verses don't. So let's read Daniel 3 just a bit. If there's any doubt in your mind that this was a conversion by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian system, if there was any doubt in your mind, the next couple verses, which again are continuous, we'll put that aside. Verse 1, chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. Yeah, he learned. Whose height was 60 cubits, variously interpreted at 8 to 9 stories. Not a head of gold, the whole image of gold. An image of gold whose height was 60 cubits, its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Skip to verse 5, please. At that time, this is the command of the decree of the image. At that time, you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, the organ, the Stratocaster, whatever you're hearing, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and you shall worship the gold image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Nebuchadnezzar didn't learn a thing. Not one thing. And as we read next time in Daniel chapter 3, it gets bad again for Daniel and his friends. What's important about this is that King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 2 is a prophecy of the image of the kingdoms. If this is all we center on in Daniel chapter 2, we have missed the narrative. It would have been better to cut Daniel 2 in half and just talk about the image and lots of prophecy. Daniel didn't understand about Rome. He didn't understand about Greece. He didn't know who Medo-Persia was. Not then. If this is all we get, then we miss. I believe there are, among many, two main themes that Daniel wants to tell us. That kingdoms rise and fall. The system we are now in, as the image portrays, is Babylonian in many, many ways. It is subtle. It is deceptive. It is ever so slowly affecting God's people. We are in many ways immune in this country. If any of you have ever traveled overseas, other than for the feast, overseas in places that are not festivals, you'll understand how very bad it is for other people. We have it pretty good. But it's still affecting us. But there will come a time when Jesus Christ will return to establish this everlasting kingdom. The second theme, which we throughout this book and throughout this chapter, is how to live when we're not of the world. Daniel and the three friends tell us how, and we have 10 chapters to go. I often have heard it said, as you have, that God calls the weak and the base. The weak and the base. Surely we are weak, very weak in many ways. But I cannot believe that God wants us. He surely does not want us to remain such. Let's read it in context. If you'll turn to 1 Corinthians 1:27. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chooses what is weak in the world to shame the strong. That's the full verse in its context. Isn't that exactly, word for word, what happened in Daniel chapter 2? It sums it up. There's also a follow-up verse that we know very well. That's 1 Peter 3:15. It tells us to be ready to give answers when we're asked questions. But it also says we are to do it with two things: humility and respect. Daniel exhibited both of those. Daniel became wise. Daniel was wise. I don't expect you to attempt interpreting dreams. In fact, that's not a real good idea. Don't go up to people and ask them if they've had a recent dream and that you'll interpret it for them. Leave it to the professionals like Joseph and Daniel. You'll get yourself in a lot of trouble. But it tells us many things, Daniel 2 does. Living in Babylon has some requirements. To whatever degree, if it's a very light Babylon that we're in now, the heavy Babylon will be later. So it's good to learn now. I think among many things, it says to be aware of the world around us. Be cognizant of those things around us and the society that you live in, but not a part of it. But not a part of it. We need to be aware. We need to be, there's a word for it, we need to be woke. So everybody under 40 just laughed at that. No, there's quite a few of you. We need to be woke in a good sense. But we also need to learn and to study God's word. We need to be aware. Recall Daniel. Daniel had no book of Daniel. I don't know if you ever thought of that. He had no book of Ezekiel. He had no book of Jeremiah. He didn't have the Psalms that we know of or anything like them. He had praises to God. He didn't have the book that you have in front of him. He had the Torah, the law, and maybe a few other writings. We don't really know what he had. Look what we have. Look what's been given to us. Indeed, we should feel very blessed and very fortunate. Daniel is in a foreign pagan land. Jerusalem, where he had been raised, was under siege and soon would be decimated, the temple destroyed. Yet he retained and grew in wisdom, knowledge, and in humility. Number two, he also tells us in Daniel 2 to keep a close group of friends of faith to confide in, confide with. These guys were forced together, these four. There may have been others, but we only know really of Daniel and his three friends. Note what Daniel did when he knew the chips were down and they were under threat of death. He went to his friends with a commonality of belief. He kept them tight to him, mainly through most parts of this book. As we'll see in the next chapter, his friends come under horrible, horrible persecution. Next, it tells us to go to God humbly and trusting, realizing we're going to God because we don't know. You were given two prayer requests today. God knows, we don't. And so we place our brother and our sister on the prayer requests into his hands. Daniel agreed and knew that God is the true source of counsel and wisdom. Humility was critical here. This entire story in Daniel chapter 2 could be categorized in another way: utter and blind arrogance. Huge arrogance. Arrogance by the king. Then he got told how great he was. So he was even more arrogant. God was telling him that. There was the king. There were the wizards who thought they knew everything and started to dialogue and lost in a debate with the king. They were arrogant. Even Arioch was arrogant. Hey, I found somebody. No, you didn't. Arrogance. Chuck Swindoll has, in his commentary on Daniel, he has a phrase: when God works, there is only room for praise, no pride. We know that Daniel exhibited this, and later on in the New Testament, Christ exhibited this. Next, Daniel constantly in this chapter thanked God. He did it often. He did before, he did during, and after the prayer. Next, he also did something that we have trouble with sometimes, and that's recognizing God to other people. I didn't say witness to people. Do you think Daniel did? Do you think Daniel gave a testimony? No, he exhibited what he believed by his faith. He would say, as many of us could, I've been blessed in spite of my shortcomings. Humility is this key. We shouldn't ever, ever get in the way. We realize and we believe that God's kingdom is coming when we do not know. Like Daniel, we should not care, but to make sure that we know that it will come. As did Daniel, we wait in expectation when Jesus Christ will come, and we hope soon and will restore this kingdom that will one day become a mountain. But until then, our acts are guided by the example that we see displayed here by Daniel to usher in this kingdom that will last forever, and there'll be no more bad dreams.